I'd like to just begin by looking at this word Christendom. In our study of medieval church history, we're in the second class. We're going to do it again next week, and then that'll be it for this segment. And I'm using this word Christendom. You've heard that word before, I'm sure. Christendom, it's kind of a funny word. It kind of brings together the words Christianity and kingdom. And etymologically, anyway, I think it's I think it's interesting. I'm using the term to refer to the synthesis of the sacred and secular aspects of the European Middle Ages, where everything, politics, economics, religious faith and practice, everything was integrated as one with the Roman Catholic Church and the secular rulers in more or less harmony. Okay? You know what I mean when I say sacred. Do you know what I mean when I say secular? Okay, secular is the Latin word for world, and it means world with regard to this temporal time. So someone whose thinking is merely secular wouldn't be considering a life after this one. All right. And as it's being used here, it's talking about the temporal affairs, what we might call the politics of the time. When we're talking about sacred, we're talking about things related to faith and worship and the practice of religion. Okay. Well, in the Middle Ages, they didn't have any idea of separation of church and state. Everything was an integrated one. And the development of what we're terming Christendom here is starting to take place. This blend of the secular and the sacred in some ways that are not very helpful. Okay. Well, foregoing the introduction for the moment here, Christmas Day 800, I'd like to talk about this first Roman numeral, the rise of the papacy. The rise of the papacy. The Roman Catholic Church, as you know, has a pope. And it's probably impossible to be objective, thoroughly objective, when talking about this, especially as Protestants, because, you know, there's all different kinds of Protestant churches and denominations, and they don't agree on everything. But one thing all Protestants agree on is that they don't like the idea of a pope. That's one of the things that binds them. That's why we're called Protestants. The Protestant Reformation, they were protesting the Roman Catholic structure of the church with this one individual at the top of the heap referred to as the Pope. Greek word papas, Latin papa, it means father. And it is the designation that came to be attached to the Bishop of Rome. What developed in church history was from a college of elders or pastors or bishops, plural rule. Over a period of time, there emerged a first among equals, a primus inter pares, one who stood above the others. Eventually, he became known as the bishop, singular. And this monarchical bishop, this one ruler bishop, developed in the early centuries of the church. First hear about it in the early second century through a guy named Ignatius of Antioch. But we really don't hear about it too much again until you get further into the second century. And then by the time where we're at, in the 500 plus years, it's pretty common that you have a monarchical bishop, one guy who's the head of the church. And if that church happens to be Rome, that Roman bishop came to be known as a pope. How did all of this come about? Well, if I can go back and get my notes straightened out, which I always should do after the last lecture. I didn't do it. We'll start talking about it. First of all, the prestige of Rome. Rome was the largest city in antiquity. It had been the seat of the empire for centuries, even before there was any Christianity, there was, even at this time we're talking about, into the Middle Ages, almost an indefinable prestige that's still attached to Rome itself. But when you look at the beginning of the Christian era, this is the city that received Paul's greatest epistle, the Epistle to the Romans. This is the place where, according to a very strong tradition, Paul was martyred and Peter was martyred. And 100 years later, the church formalized that with some dedication of the martyrdom of Peter and Paul being there, built a church where Peter had supposedly been martyred. So you have this prestige that attaches to Rome. And besides that, you have this interesting passage of Scripture. And if you have your Bibles, you might want to open to Matthew chapter 16. Because this is where much of the primacy of Peter is found. There is a significant point in all of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where Jesus asks a question of his disciples. You know, in the synoptic gospels, we learn about Jesus' identity, or Jesus' identity is presented from his beginnings and birth as a human being. And it only slowly dawns on people who it is we're dealing with. Gospel of John is totally different. It begins with Jesus' eternal preexistence. It's kind of Jesus from heaven down. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are Jesus from the earth up. And as his identity is being revealed by the miracles that he performs and his authoritative teaching and walking on the water and what manner of man is this? There comes a point in each of the synoptic gospels, and we find it here in Matthew chapter 16, where Jesus says to his disciples, he says, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And he gives some answers. Some say John, some say Jeremiah, some say one of the prophets. "But who do you say that I am?" And you remember who answers? Peter. Peter answers. And he says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus immediately commends him by saying, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of John, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." And that's found there in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. Jesus then says these words, "And you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." So, kind of returns the favor. Peter says, "You are the Christ," and Jesus says, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." And he goes on to tell him he's going to give him the keys of the kingdom. This is a very significant what Jesus says here. And how are we to understand this? Well, this is how the Roman Catholic Church understands Peter. They actually would regard Peter as the bishop of the church at Rome. Now, there's really scant biblical evidence that Peter was at Rome. Certainly wasn't there when Paul wrote his letter, because Paul spent the entire 16th chapter greeting individual people at Rome, and it would have been the height of insult to greet everybody except Peter. Peter's not mentioned. There is a mention, though, in Peter's first letter, 1 Peter 5:13, where he gives greetings from those that are at Babylon, and Babylon is thought to be a code word for Rome. So that would situate Peter at Rome. Anyway, the Roman Church believes that Peter was the first bishop of Rome. And added to that, they would say that Peter's primacy is really throughout the New Testament. In every synoptic gospel where Jesus names his disciples, Peter is the very first one named. when Jesus is talking to the inner circle of the three, it's Peter, James, and John. In Acts chapter 1, when someone has to get up and give the sermon at Pentecost, it's Peter. First out of the boat. First to open his mouth at Transfiguration. You know, Peter. And so they would say, this is very significant. And Jesus says, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. The thinking then goes that because the church is an ongoing institution and society, the Bishop of Rome, Peter's primacy, must also continue. And this is the idea of not just Peter's primacy, but Peter's succession. And the idea of apostolic succession comes in this way. Now, it may not surprise you to learn that evangelicals disagree with this interpretation of this passage of Scripture. And they've disagreed in different ways. I know as a very young Christian, about a year old in the Lord, 1973, I went to Israel. And we were at one point on our tour at a place called Caesarea Philippi. And while we were standing there, it was a very, very fascinating place, beautiful, beautiful place. There's this huge reservoir, and in back of the reservoir is this huge rock. I mean, it's not the Rock of Gibraltar, but it is a huge rock. And as I'm sitting there with some other tourists, an Englishman comes up and says, do you know the significance of this place? And I said, no. And he opened to Matthew chapter 16. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? I got goosebumps. We're in the very place. And then he went on to explain that when Jesus said to Peter, on this rock I will build my church, he was pointing to this huge rock, something very solid and something very stable. I thought that was very impressive. But while that might be a possible interpretation, there's no indication in the text itself that Jesus was gesturing to the rock when he spoke to Peter. So that's one possible interpretation, but I wouldn't want to hang my hat on it. Other evangelicals, Protestants, have looked at this passage. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Blessed are you, Simon, son of John, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven has revealed it to you, and you are Peter, and on this rock. I know what the rock is. It's the revelatory confessional faith that Peter had. After all, he didn't get it from the earth. Flesh and blood didn't reveal it, but the Father revealed that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God. So Jesus must be referring to not Peter as a person being the rock, but the rock being that solid knowledge coming from the Father that Jesus is indeed the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And that's pretty good, because we know Jesus is the foundation of the church. It says that in 1 Corinthians. And so we know he's the solid rock. It's one of his designations. That sounds a lot better to our evangelical ears, doesn't it? Yeah, but you got to be careful there. It really does seem that Jesus isn't saying, and I tell you, on this rock I'll build my church. He says, and I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. And so just trying to be faithful to the text, I think we have to say there's something very significant about Peter when it comes to the foundation of the church. And indeed there is. He's an apostle. The apostles and prophets, Paul tells us, are the foundation of the church. They were the eyewitnesses of Jesus Christ, and they wrote down what they saw and heard. And we base our faith on the eyewitnesses of Jesus. Peter is significant. We're told that on the day of Pentecost, but Jesus told his followers in Acts chapter 1 that you'll be my witnesses when the Holy Spirit comes upon you. You'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the uttermost parts of the world. And on the day of Pentecost, when the Spirit was poured out in Jerusalem, Peter was there preaching. Samaria, Acts chapter 8, Peter came down with John, and they laid hands on those disciples, and the Holy Spirit came upon them. And the uttermost parts of the world, a couple chapters later, Peter's the one that goes to preach to Cornelius, the first Gentile, to be filled with the Spirit. So he seems to be using these keys of the kingdom to open the doors to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the uttermost parts of the world. I'd say that there was a foundational ministry that Peter had. So we want to give Peter his due. But none of this is to say that there is necessarily some kind of succession. That's not in view. And as a matter of fact, it's not recognized. Peter was no more primary at the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15 than was James. Peter was regarded as the apostle to the circumcision, but Paul, the apostle to the uncircumcision. So there's no special in a sense that he's apart from all of the others. He's representative of the apostles and certainly the first to be mentioned. There's nothing wrong with giving Peter his due. But he's the Peter that, even though he said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," a couple verses later said, no, you can't go to the cross. And Jesus goes from commending him to calling him Satan. He's the same Peter that certainly did walk on the water, but then, fell into the waves. He's the same Peter that fell into some legalism at Galatians. So he's a man. Okay, we don't place our faith on a man. However, as an apostolic witness to Jesus Christ, we want to give him his due. Anyway, this is one of the reasons that you find a Roman bishop becoming a pope and being in charge of much. In addition to that, in the development of the church at Rome and the bishops of Rome, they often found themselves in a place where they were called upon to coordinate rebuttal to heresy and to mediate in disputes. And generally, they were very successful in how they handled themselves. They were pretty good managers, pretty good administrators. One of the differences between the church in the East and the church in the West, when I talk about the East, I'm talking about Asia Minor and, those churches over there. They were key in the development of theology in the early church. We get the Council of Nicaea, the Council of Chalcedon, that gives us definitions and formula for the Trinity, for the person of Christ. We don't find that sort of thing happening in the West. The Greeks, secularly speaking, were the originators of Western civilization. The Romans were the managers and the developers of Western civilization. Similarly, when we come to the church, the Eastern portion of the church, that Greek-speaking portion of the church, they were key in the development of theological concept, in taking Scripture and seeing how it harmonized. Not so much in the West. In the West, however, they took those doctrinal formulations and put them into practice in a way that Christianity grew and spread. This is a general difference between East and West. And in the West, the Roman bishops were especially effective at managing, at administrating, in getting things going. You can have a wonderful internal combustion engine, but if you don't have some kind of a transmission to get that power to the wheels, the car's not going to go anywhere. The Romans knew how to get the power to the wheels. A couple of guys in particular that I have mentioned here, Leo the First and Gregory the First, also known as Leo the Great and Gregory the Great. These men lived, first of all, we'll talk about Leo. His years were 390 to 461 AD. And Leo was the bishop of Rome that played a significant role in two very important things that happened during his tenure. The first was something I just alluded briefly to a moment ago. It was the Christological controversy of the 5th century. Middle part of the 5th century, there had been a debate that had been brewing for some time about who was Jesus Christ. Was he a divine person and a human person in one body somehow? Was he a divine person with a divine nature and somewhat human? How are we supposed to understand the humanity and the divinity of Christ? And eventually, what developed over a very fascinating and very unedifying period in the history of the early church was the Chalcedonian definition. At the Council of Chalcedon, the church finally came to a position where they viewed Jesus Christ as one person with two natures, a divine and a human nature that were in perfect hypostatic union with one another. This is deep stuff. It doesn't get any more deep and miraculous than the miracle of the incarnation. How does God become flesh? Yeah, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. You puzzle over that, it'll make your head spin. Well, they were trying to wrestle with this to try to fence out heresy. At a very significant point in time, remember I said the Eastern churches were very key in the formulation of doctrine, but that's not to say that the West wasn't involved. As a matter of fact, Leo weighed in at the crisis point with his writing on the subject. It was called Leo's Tome, T-O-M-E. And we think of a tome as a rather large book, but actually Leo's Tome was a little booklet. Little booklet of several pages, and in Leo's Tome, he had cobbled together, I'm sure with the help of others, a very crisp and clear doctrinal statement that essentially is the Chalcedonian definition. So, here we have this controversy roiling the East and the churches. Leo, the Bishop of Rome, steps in at a significant crisis point and carries the day with his writing. That's a real feather in his cap. Another feather in his cap occurred in a totally different type of situation when no one less than Attila the Hun with his hordes were at the gates of Rome threatening to ransack the city. And Leo, with his administrative and diplomatic skill, somehow bargains his way out of it with payments or something like that. And so Rome is kept from being destroyed by the Huns. These two things really helped to cause Leo's stock to go way up. So Leo also had some ideas about the significance of the Bishop of Rome. He really thought when he spoke that Peter was speaking through him. Not that he was necessarily channeling, but you know that something was happening there. In Leo's mind, that's what he believed. And he said these words. He said, "The dignity of Saint Peter is not lacking even in an unworthy heir." So, that's Leo. Fast forward about a century and a half, there's another pope that gets this designation as great. His name was Gregory. And Gregory was very significant. He was ranked as one of the doctors of the Latin Church, Latin meaning Western Church. And that designation, a doctor of the church, that was only given to four men, Ambrose, Augustine, Jerome, who translated the Vulgate version, and Gregory. So they were considered to be the highest luminaries in the Latin church. Gregory was the interpreter of Augustine to the Middle Ages. Gregory himself came from a wealthy family. And he had been in the employ of the empire as a diplomat. He had some real skills. As I said, he was a wealthy man, but at some point he decided he wanted to leave his wealth. He gave it to the poor, and he entered a monastery. He actually became the abbot of a monastery and wanted to live the contemplative life. Well, there came a point in history where the Bishop of Rome, the seat, was vacant because that bishop had died in a plague, and it had been vacant for about 6 months. And Gregory, was such an attractive and well-known and well-loved personality that he was actually made bishop by popular acclaim. That happened a few times in the ancient church. A guy just stood out so head and shoulders above all the rest. We must have this man to be our bishop. And so that's how he was installed as the bishop of Rome. And just fishing around for the rest of my notes here. Please be patient with me. It's a vain search, I'm afraid. Well, I'll just try to go from memory a little bit. Ah, yeah, here's another thing about Gregory. Have you ever heard of the Gregorian chants? That was from Gregory, also known as plain chant. He was an innovator in church music. He wrote a rule for the secular clergy that was similar to what St. Benedict did for the regular or monastic clergy. They developed a couple of different ways of looking at clergy. The regular priests were those who were in monasteries. The secular priests were those who were out in the world among the people. Okay? And Benedict wrote a rule for monks in monasteries. That's the regular priesthood. Gregory did the same thing for secular priests. And he was very effective at what he did. His theology, unfortunately, wasn't quite sound. He believed that man was fallen in Adam, but it wasn't a radical fall. Man was only weakened. And so he needed grace to get him started. But once grace got you started, you really had to kind of keep the thing going pretty much yourself. You need to do a lot of good works because you want your good works to outweigh your bad works. Otherwise, when you die, you'll have to go to purgatory and work it off. So you have the beginnings of these sorts of things. It was legalistic. It says in baptism, you're saved, but if you sin after that, you have got to pay the price, and the way you pay that price is through penance. So as you can see, we've come a long way from trusting in the simple cross of Jesus Christ. It's very sad, but that's the way it was. That's the way it developed. Another thing about Gregory was he faced a similar situation that Leo did, not with Huns at the gate, but the Lombard tribes at the gate, barbarian tribes, and he was successful in dealing with them. So, these two guys in particular, Leo and Gregory, were such outstanding leaders of their time that they raised again this prestige of Rome. Well, let's just take a little detour in our outline and skip from Roman numeral 2 for the moment to Roman numeral 3, because there's something else going on at this time in the history of the world, and that's the development of Islam. Muhammad the Prophet, born about 570 AD in the Arabian Peninsula. At that time in Arabia, there was all kinds of different worship going on, worship of fetishes and whatnot, polytheistic tribesmen, Bedouin tribesmen arguing with one another and fighting their little tribal wars. And this is the kind of world that Muhammad was born into. But then he received his revelation from God, the Holy Scriptures divinely given to him, the Quran, and he was subsequently, well, he left Mecca. Whether he was actually driven out of Mecca or not, not sure, but his Hegira took him from Mecca to Medina, where he shared his thoughts and his ideas and the revelation that he received, and a following gathered around him. And after a number of years, in 630, he returned to Mecca in triumph. And he only lived another couple years after that, but Islam caught on so rapidly that within a couple of years, much of the Arabian Peninsula had become Muslim. And then after his death, those that followed him, in a short period of time, I think within a decade, just about the whole peninsula had become Muslim. And then they began to expand rapidly. First of all, eastward, Persia, up into Palestine and Syria, all the way almost into India. and then westward into Egypt and across North Africa. The thing about Islam that was, it was so simple. Islam means surrender. The whole idea is to surrender or submit to the divine God, this absolutely one monotheistic Allah. There is one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. That was the first of the Islamic pillars of faith, that confession. And another one was to pray five times a day. And a third was to give alms to the Muslim poor. And a fourth was to observe the holy fast of Ramadan, 1 month where you don't enjoy any temporal pleasures, food, drink, anything else between sunrise and sunset. And the fifth was to make a pilgrimage, if at all possible, to the holy city of Mecca. There's a five, very simple, caught on. One of the reasons it caught on was that at this period in time, the Byzantine Empire and its Christianity had become rather decadent, and they were not very good at administrating their realms. And so it was a weakened form of Christianity that existed there, and it fell pretty quickly. Asia Minor, that was a little more difficult. Across North Africa, things went pretty well. They met some resistance with the Berber peoples in the western part of North Africa. But eventually, within a century or two, they're crossing the Strait at Gibraltar and going into the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, and pressing northward until they get into southern France. And then a man named Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, at the famous Battle of Tours, defeated the Muslim Moors, and that ended up being the high water mark of the Muslim advance into Europe. Although I think we'd have to say in this day and age that there's a great Muslim presence in Europe today, but in the Middle Ages, that was the high water mark. The result of this was that the church, and I'm talking about Rome now, talking about what is developing as the Roman Catholic Church, is finding itself more and more isolated. First of all, there's this general east-west split. Remember, Constantine, back in the early 300s, had moved the seat of the empire from Rome to Constantinople, present-day Istanbul. And even leaving an administrative center there for a while, the administrative center moved from Rome, which is on the western part of the Italian peninsula, to a city called Ravenna on the eastern side of the Italian peninsula. So Rome is without any kind of an imperial presence for the most part, and it's kind of left to act on its own, and that, of course, aids the emergence of the Roman bishop as the, you know, the most significant personage there. But politically, they're feeling rather isolated. Also, we talked about last week how the German barbarian tribes had been pressing them on the north. And in the course of history, many of these German barbarian tribes became Christian, but they became Christian in a heretical form of Christianity called Arianism, where they viewed Jesus as less than divine. And so that wasn't helpful. But remember, there was one tribe that went in the direction of Nicene or Trinitarian Christianity. And what tribe was that from last week? Do you remember? It was the Franks. And there was a king who had a Constantinian-type conversion, apparently. And his name was... No, Clovis. Clovis. And Clovis was... this was last week. I don't expect you to remember. I can't even remember what happened yesterday. But last week we had this king named Clovis, and he was the head of what was called the Merovingian dynasty of the Franks. Clovis. And he threw his weight in with the church at Rome and strengthened Western Catholic Christianity. Okay? And this is, we're talking about 500 A.D. As time goes on, the line of Clovis, as it passes down to his heirs, is not very strong. Teenage sons die. It is a rather decrepit line. And besides, the center of political power really doesn't continue to rest with the king and his line. But it moves over into this, the designation of these guys is called mayor of palace. I don't know if you've ever heard that term. But the mayors of palace would correspond roughly to like what a prime minister is vis-a-vis the Queen of England. You know, you can have a royal figurehead, but they really don't have the power. The power is really in the prime minister. Well, these individuals called mayors of palace were developing, and one of them actually became guy we just mentioned, Charles Martel, and this is in the early 700s, and he has a son, and his son is called Pepin, but I like this, Pepin the Short. And Pepin the Short was a significant individual. Back to the outline here. We're in Roman numeral 2. The decline of the Charlemagne, the decline of the Merovingian dynasty, and then Charles Martel and Pepin the Short. I mentioned about Charles and what he did in stopping the Moors. These guys were powerful generals or warlords or whatever you want to call them, and they commanded armies, and they were successful. And I might as well fill this out while I'm at it. The next guy in line after Pepin is his son, Charlemagne. And that's the French for Charles the Great. Remember, the Frankish kings were French, German, what's going to develop into France and Germany. Let's talk about these guys for a few minutes here. Pepin the Short, who succeeded his father, Charles Martel, had conferred upon him papal approval. Remember I said these guys weren't kings, but they really did aspire to legitimacy. And so Pepin the Short managed to get kind of a papal approval. Please keep in mind the whole background. What we're talking about here is the development of this idea of Christendom. How does the secular ruler and the spiritual ruler, what's that relationship like? Because it's very, very important. Well, Pepin, who succeeded his father Charles Martel, had conferred upon him papal approval of the legitimacy of his position. In return, Pepin conferred upon the Pope political authority over a strip of land across the Italian peninsula, the center of the Italian peninsula. It came to be known as the Papal States. Maybe you heard of them. They were under the control of the Vatican until 1870, as a matter of fact. This made the Pope a temporal ruler as well as a spiritual ruler. He's got real estate, and he uses that real estate. Church is becoming a very wealthy landowner during this time. There's something else that was going on here. There's a false account that had circulated for some time. And in this false account, Constantine the Great, that's going back to the early 300s, had granted the Bishop of Rome at that time, Sylvester, and the Church of Rome precedence over all the churches, East and West, plus temporal authority, not spiritual, but temporal authority as well, over all of the West. This false account, it's known as the pseudo-Isidorian Decretals. Isidore was a presbyter or a bishop at Seville, and somehow it got attached to his name. It's doubtful he did it. Some mischievous, conniving, skillful little hand drew these things up. Somebody who knew what documents looked like. And these false accounts supposedly given... And here's actually how the story goes is Constantine had leprosy, and Pope Sylvester, Bishop of Rome, prayed for him and healed him of his leprosy. And in gratitude for what Sylvester had done, Constantine the Great said, you shall have authority over all of the churches everywhere, east and west, and you shall have temporal authority over the entire realm of the West. It was false, but it sounded really good, and the bishops of Rome, the popes, used these false claims, this so-called donation of Constantine, to their advantage to press their claims for authority. Another couple hundred years later, Pope Nicholas I made use of these and other spurious documents, but they were later shown to be forgeries. But at any rate, this is how papal leaders are pressing their claims. Okay. Now we come to Charles the Great. By the way, if you're wondering why Pepin is called Pepin the Short, I'm not really sure. But according to Einhard, the contemporary biographer of Charlemagne, and whether this is true or not, I don't know, but according to Einhard, Charlemagne was 7 feet tall. Now, I don't know if that's when he had his armor on or his high-heeled shoes or what, but so if he was that tall, then that probably is why his father was called Pepin the Short. That's just a guess. I don't really know. Yeah, he was only 6'5". Yeah, it's funny. I remember seeing a picture of one of my friends with his family, and they all look really, really short. And then there's this one young man that is just, I mean, way taller than everybody else. And I said, was your family all really that short? And he said, no, that one in the back, he was 7'5". So you get the idea from, you can get the wrong idea from a picture. Anyway, the papal coronation of Charles the Great. This is what was happening. We're coming up to the year 800 AD, and we've gone through the time of Charles Martel and Pepin the Short, and this guy in particular is making common cause with the Bishop of Rome, but that bishop's position, that pope's position, is always a little bit tenuous, and when we're coming up to the end of the century, he is getting in a lot of opposition from some of the nobles at Rome. At one point, they actually kidnapped him and absconded with him. His friends managed to get him back, but he was really needing some help. And so Charlemagne made a trip over the Alps and came to Rome in the summer of the year 800. And he, through his considerable support, he came with his army, through his considerable support behind Pope Leo III. Then on Christmas Day in the Basilica of St. Peter's, it's not the same basilica we have today, but Charlemagne went in there to pray. And as he was praying, as he rose from prayer, Pope Leo, unknownst to Charlemagne, came over with a very ornate crown and placed it upon his head. It was on Charlemagne's head, not on your brother's head. Anyway, placed the crown on his head. Charlemagne was not pleased with this. Now, why would he not be pleased with that? Isn't that a nice thing? That was a nice thing to do. Give me this ornate, jeweled crown. Why would he not be pleased? Yeah. Who's greater, the one who wears the crown or one who confers the crown? I give you this crown. That's a little bit different. So he wasn't happy about that because Charlemagne was a big shot king in his own right. And of course, he had already gotten through his father and his grandfather the kind of spiritual approval that they desired to be thought of as a dynasty. And they did bring about this thing called the Carolingian dynasty. But that was the deal. I have a picture here, if I can find. Oh, yeah. Here's a picture that Charlemagne would have liked, this one. Now, Leo is the little guy down here on the right. This is Charlemagne on the left. Who's the big one here? He's conferring some blessings, and he's got a key in his lap. Who might that be? Yeah, Peter. He had the keys to the kingdom. This is Peter. He's conferring on Leo the papal stole. And over here, he's giving a banner, which is a warlike thing that kings rode into battle with, to Charlemagne. Now, Charlemagne liked this one because notice the level that the two figures are on. They're on equal level. That's very significant. This little picture, and I'll bring it over here so you can see too. This little picture sums up the ideal idea of Christendom, where the secular and the sacred ruler are on the same level. In point of fact, it was never quite that ideal. As a matter of fact, I think next week we'll get into it a little bit more. There's this dance that involves who's going to be leading and who's going to be following. You know, gentlemen, when you dance the dance floor with your wives, or, you know, somebody's leading, somebody's following. Well, they never could quite figure out who was leading and following. It's an interesting little dance that was played. All right. So this is the coronation of Charles the Great. Significant. Well, Charles himself brought about, this was a very interesting guy. He brought about somewhat of a renaissance at this period of time. It's called the Carolingian Renaissance. And besides being a very effective warlord who conquered vast territories, had a long-standing war with the Saxons, but he controlled, Charlemagne did, at his height, an amount of land that was more than anybody had since Theodosius back in like the 4th or 5th, 4th century. Very successful king. But he wasn't just interested in acquiring power and property. He was also interested in learning. And he sought out the finest minds in the Western world and brought them to his court at Aachen. And started schools. The most famous educator was a guy named Alcuin of York, who came over from York and who, you know, they made real advances in education at this time. The seven liberal arts, trivium and the quadrivium, the trivium being the grammar, rhetoric, dialectic, and the quadrivium being the study of arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. Altogether, you see the development of what we would now call the arts and the sciences that come out of this in your liberal arts colleges. And, you know, but this is kind of where the beginnings of this European universities are going to eventually come out of this. But one of the interesting things was, as I was reading this book last night by Hoyt, he said one of the benefits of the Carolingian Renaissance is the very book that you're reading, the Roman type, the whole idea of capitals and minuscules, and the way that they wrote as opposed to the big bold Gothic and the Merovingian cursive was this whole idea of what we now have as Roman type. Because in these this educational Renaissance period, Charlemagne, through monastic schools and whatnot, developed a lot more of what are called scriptoria, where they copied books from the ancient past. And these people were not brilliant in and of themselves, but what they were very faithful, dogged, assiduous in giving themselves to the copying of ancient texts. And scholars guess that probably 80% of the works of antiquity that we have today are as a result of the Carolingian Renaissance and the effort that they made to preserve learning during that time. Another thing that they did was that the Latin Vulgate version of the Bible, which Jerome penned back in about 400 AD, had just been copied in different ways in different parts of the Western world, and there was a real degeneration in the text. And one would copy a mistake and add another mistake, and after a while, it just really became very bad. And one of the things that Charlemagne and the scholars under him did was they got together as many of these texts as they could, and they put together a much better preserved Vulgate version of the Latin text. Now, when printing was developed in the late 1400s, the early printers appreciated the Carolingian manuscript of capitals, small letters, the way they did their words. So they patterned their typeset after the Carolingian scribes. And that has led to the kind of, you know, books we have today. And the, you know, so I thought that was very interesting. I didn't know that. I just read that last night. There are other things that happened during this time, but I'd like to just mention in the few minutes that we have remaining a little bit about what we'll call the lower Christianity in the medieval period. You know, we talk about kings and popes and scholars and, yeah, but what about the ordinary people? Well, Williston Walker, a church historian of about a generation or two ago, refers to this popular or, you know, man on the street version of Christianity as lower Christianity. And he said that there was a great deal of, in the popular mind, of the veneration of saints and martyrs, and especially the veneration of Mary, that dated all the way back to the second century, but really begins to pick up steam at this point in the church's history. Now, you know, there were certainly those who suffered for the faith back during the times of persecution, and they couldn't, of course, suffer as martyrs anymore after Christianity became a legal religion. But those who had suffered, the bones of the martyrs became very, very important as holy relics. And there was a real industry in holy relics. I mean, I've heard it said that if you manage to put together all of the original splinters of the cross that had been claimed, you'd have enough wood to make the boardwalk at Ocean City. I don't know, but definitely you have this statement made by the Seventh General Council that holy relics, if any bishop from this time forward is found consecrating a temple without holy relics, he shall be deposed as a transgressor of the ecclesiastical traditions. So the veneration of saints and holy relics, I mean, we're moving quite a bit away from what Jesus said to the woman at the well about true worship being in spirit and in truth. Also, the development of Mariolatry, worship of Mary, is gaining steam here as well. During that debate over the nature and the natures and the person of Christ, one of the first things that keyed that off was that Mary was referred to as Theotokos, God-bearer. Nestorius was one who wasn't comfortable with that. He preferred the term Christotokos, Christ-bearer, to describe Mary. And that was one of the things that kind of set off this controversy. Theologically, there's nothing wrong with Theotokos because it really was God that Mary was bearing, okay? But Mary begins to, at this time, take on a status much greater than I'm sure she would have wanted and that the scriptures would accord her. She is blessed. The Bible is very clear about that. But one of the things that developed in the controversy over Christ was in some parts of the Christian world, the monophysite view became strong. And that's the idea that Christ is one person and he has a dominant divine nature and kind of a very small human nature. In other words, it's the monophysite, one physis, one nature, tending toward one nature. When that happens, Christ becomes more and more divine. And Christ becoming so divine and so different from us recedes up into the heavens. And he's such a regal and an austere figure, along with God the Father, Now, Jesus Christ in the Monophysite thinking is way, way up there, so far transcendent from us. In the vacuum that's left, Mary seems to be a much more human and approachable figure. And as it's been said, if you want something from your father, ask your mother. So Mary takes on this, you know, approachable, more human, the ideal of the Virgin. And so in the popular mind, the relic worship, the holy martyrs, the saints, Mary, you begin to have this whole section of intercessors and mediators, and Mary is a mediatrix between the believer and God. Very sad. This is what is developing. Now, obviously, we're really kind of pretty far away from the simple form of Christianity that we're familiar with. But that's the kind of world that we're seeing right now.